All right, welcome everybody. I think we're still kind of figuring out what we're doing because we have lost due to the striking down of Kara Griffin's voice by the it's bad. So without her leadership, we will attempt poorly to fill the enormous shoes that she usually is wearing. And so I am here, David Teachout. You may have known me as I played a doctor on TV, but also have given plenty of presentations here for good and ill. And I'm joined by Rob Palmer, who is, Collective Logic badass. Rob?
Well, thank you, David. And I will try to do my best. Although I have been stricken apparently by the same thing that has taken Kara's voice. Their voice was, she's attributing her laryngitis to the Canadian fire. And it seems to have triggered my pneumonia, which led to another condition, which let me go to the hospital. I thought I was having a heart attack, frankly, and it was pancreatitis, which can feel like that. I spent a day and a half there and I'm not quite recovered from either, but I'll do my best. Thank you, Canada.
Hey, yeah. So basically, Jeebus is striking down the unbelievers. And so we have two down. And now I have to explain why I have not been struck down. Although I have an eye infection. So maybe he was aiming for the throat and got my eye.
Very bad aim.
A very bad aim. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's an alternative reading of Abraham and his son Isaac. Like, I mean, the knife was gonna go into him, but he skipped it.
Not quite as effective. I mean, like, everyone thought, well, okay, Matt Dillahunty went down with multiple cardiac things. You think that would take him out? But no, science saved him. Science was better than God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If I get an eye patch, though, it'll be awesome. It'll be moving. So with that, Rob, shall we introduce the man, the myth, the legend?
Legend. Yes, Dr. Dalla Ray is the founder and president of this organization, Recovering from Religion, which is not to be confused with Freedom from Religion Foundation, which everyone seems to do. He's been a psychologist for over 30 years and is the author of 4 books, including The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture, and Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. Dr. Ray has been a student of religion most of his life and holds a master's degree in religion as well as a bachelor's degree in sociology, anthropology, with a doctorate in psychology. Welcome, Dr. Ray.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Dave. Now I'm going to try and get this thing up here and running. We had a large practice session earlier, and I flunked my test here. So here we go. All right, I'm going. Thank you. So this is going to be, I'm going to try and get through this in an hour. This is a variation of the talk I gave as I toured Australia back in February and March. And I also always had a hard time getting through it in a single hour, but we'll try to make that. And Dave is going to put some boundaries around me. So this is called Religious Trauma and Your Brain. I want to encourage you to go get a pencil and a piece of paper and be ready to take some notes. And I don't mean notes for, a test later. I mean some notes because I'm going to be throwing some slides up and we'll be going through them fairly quickly. I'll be asking some, do you experience this? Do you experience that? That kind of thing. And I'd like you to try and identify some of the things you may have experienced. Or just write them down, whichever one you want. But anyway, as we go through this, hopefully you'll see that some of the things I'm talking about actually apply to a lot of us in some way, shape, or form. My purpose here is to raise awareness about what we call religious trauma is. I'm not here to diagnose. In fact, I'm not too fond of diagnosing unless it's done by a professional that knows what the hell they're doing. We're not here to diagnose anybody, and I'm not here to help you diagnose yourself. I'm not really that interested in diagnosis. I'm interested in behavior and thought patterns. You may or may not experience trauma or feel that you've been traumatized, but you still may have certain behavior or certain thought patterns. And that's what we're here to talk about here today. So let's jump in. The human brain is a developmental process that begins literally before birth and goes at least until 20 or 24 or 25 in its major development. That's, you know, that's a pretty long time for this what 3-pound thing we've got in between our ears to develop. But this brain that we carry around is unique. Every one of us has a different development. We develop faster or slower. We develop certain pieces better than others. I mean, some of you out there are really good at music. Other people aren't. That's a part of brain function, of course. Some people are better at hearing higher tone voices than lower tone voices. Some people can process information and certain kinds of information faster and others slower. But we know from simple research, or not simple research, but research going back many years, that the brain goes through windows, if you will. I like to call them windows, where the brain opens up to do some task. And then once that task is fairly complete, the brain shuts that window down. The most common example you all could relate to is language. When you're, you know, 1, 2, 3 years old, you are absorbing whatever the language is in your immediate environment. And your brain is programmed to just absorb that massive amounts of language information in that short, you know, 2, 3, 4 years there. And it continues until you're about 12 years old. And at 12 years old, the brain says, okay, we've had enough of this. We don't need any more. And it starts closing down the window. That's why after about 12 or 13 years of age, it's harder and harder for many people to learn a second or third language. Now, if you already have, let's say you lived in Switzerland and you were exposed to Italian and German and French all while you're growing up, you'd learn all three of those languages during this window that is open for language acquisition. And some of the research shows that people who have had multiple languages exposure can acquire other languages later in life. It's like the window doesn't quite slam as tight as it does for some of us. I tell you, by the time I was in college and trying to take French, I was the absolute worst student in French. I love French. I could read it pretty well, but I just could not get the pronunciation. I'd put the wrong emphasis on the incorrect syllable, and I would never get it right. So language is one example. You like that, David? There's a lot of other things that the brain opens up and closes down. This is just one example. But I want you to keep this in mind as we go through my talk tonight. There's so many different components of brain development that are happening simultaneously and separately and in different speeds. And it's a lot, because the brain is not one unitary thing. As we all know, we have a right brain, we have a left brain. And those two components seem to almost specialize in most human beings. We're not going to go into that today. But that's another example of, you know, the different. One brain side is processing language. The other brain side is probably processing emotions and things like that to simplify things. And I'm going to simplify a lot of things today. So this is not going to be highly detailed. It's conceptual. It's a framework for us to understand what's going on. So going back 70 years, we've got all sorts of research on normal developmental tasks that the brain goes through. We know that the brain opens up and learn and creates structures, systems, methods for recognizing faces. I'm starting at a very, very early age, like within a month, the infant can distinguish between male and female faces sometimes, can distinguish between, by 3 or 4 months, a baby, an infant can distinguish between mother face and non-mother face. And the interesting thing is our brains are not genetically programmed like many insects or many other organisms to function in exactly the same way. All our brains are designed to do is to have a framework so that when we're born, there's a component in our brain that looks for the shape of a face. That's why no baby ever mistakes a dog, the family dog, for its mother, because the family dog face does not fit the template that our genetics have been programmed to look for. But it's a very loose genetic program. So a child can get very a lot of information about the mother's face at a very early age and will never mistake their mother for the dog, or will never mistake their mother for somebody else after about 4 or 5 months. We've talked about language already. Social skills. There's a time in which the window opens up and the child age 4, 5, 6, 7 is learning how to interact, negotiate, understand, all the things you see children are doing at that age. You see children learning empathy. You can see a child when they are upset about something because somebody else is upset about something. And that's the beginnings of things like empathy. Well, that opens up, the child learns those skills, and then it tends to close back down, maybe by the time they're in their early 20s. And last, and certainly not least, is attachment. Children, and we're going to come back and talk a lot about attachment later, but there's a certain window in time in which the child is looking around in his environment and say, who is going to protect me? How am I going to stay safe in this environment? And that's who they attach to. They attach to the caregiver figure. And that's a very important thing for humans. We need to know who to attach to. A child that doesn't have an attachment is, going to wander off and not obey their parents, or wander off and get eaten by a lion, All right, so those are all examples. I'm trying to set it up so we understand what the brain is doing and why it's doing it and why it doesn't stay open forever. These tasks are done, you move on, because you got higher level tasks to do as you move through. So let's look briefly at a definition of trauma. Rob, could I get you to read that?
Yes. Trauma results from an event, series of events, or set of circumstances that is experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful or threatening, and that has lasting adverse effects on the individual's functioning and physical, social, or emotional well-being.
Thanks, Rob. So there are developmental stages that we go through, as I've already kind of talked about, but those stages can be interrupted or disrupted in ways that cause changes to the brain or inhibit us from completing developmental tasks. So there are traumatic events that can happen to children. And when that traumatic event happens, whatever that brain is doing at that time, that child's environment, well, think about this. What about a 3 or 4 year old child in Ukraine right now who has to listen to artillery or bombs, or has had a relative or somebody they knew get hurt or even killed? If it's a child at a certain developmental phase, that's going to be burned into their brain. If there is a lot of attachment, the mother and the child are disrupted, they're pulled out of their home, they're forced to go to some other country, and the mother's not able to spend time with the child at the exact time when attachment is happening, that can disrupt the attachment that the child experiences. And we have really interesting research going back 50, 60 years on this. I'm sure some of you, if you've had psychology 101 or maybe a little later psychology course, you may have heard of the Harry Harlow monkey experiments. And excuse me. While those experiments would be declared quite unethical today, they were experiments that showed when you disrupt the attachment of the infant monkey from the mother, it really creates problems for how well the baby can survive. I won't go into the details of how that experiment was done, but there were several different conditions. And mainly what they did was they prevented the baby from actually having a real body to attach to. In one condition, they just gave the baby a bottle on a on a wireframe mother with no, wasn't even a live mother. It was a wireframe in the shape of another monkey. And what they found was it was really disruptive to the development of the baby monkey. We have another natural experiment, a horrible experiment that happened with the orphanages in Romania before Ceausescu was overthrown as a dictator in Romania back in the late 80s, I believe it was, early 90s. Children, they had a policy that really birthed a lot of children that were not wanted or that people couldn't take care of for various reasons. And so they had enormous numbers of children put into nurseries. And they also had a philosophy in those nurseries that babies only needed to be fed. They didn't need to be held or anything like that. And so you have hundreds, if not thousands, of babies in Romania being raised with only a milk bottle in their mouth or adequate food and sustenance, but no emotional attention, no holding, no cuddling, no talking to by the mother, and that sort of thing. Well, as you might imagine, those babies grew up to have incredibly serious emotional dysfunctions, difficulties. They had no one, they never attached to anyone. Their brains did not properly develop around social skills. I mean, there were just lots, the list was enormously long, and it was a tragedy. Oftentimes you see caregiver absence, you know, when the caregiver is there for a while and then is gone for extended periods of time at the very time that the child needs to have attachment, it can cause developmental problems for the child. We see this in foster children. I've seen this a lot in foster children. Where's the stability in their life? Where's the attachment that protects them, teaches them, supports them? It's just not there for them. So these are common problems that we're going to come back and understand how this all comes together around religious trauma. So what we see is that trauma causes distortion. This is a picture of a tree that literally is 100 feet from where I'm sitting in a small forest that's around my house. Not long after I moved where I live now, a larger tree fell onto this tree. And it probably stayed there for a year or so before I was able to get out and saw the old dead tree down that had fell down on it. But in the meantime, the smaller tree is trying to right itself. It's trying to get back up towards the sun because this tree was almost totally laid down on the ground from almost, not quite. Anyway, it started growing back up. I got the old tree off of it, but as you can see by this picture, this tree will never be straight again. And I live in Kansas, so the tallest, straightest trees are most likely to survive tornadoes or high wind storms. But a tree like this is going to have a harder time surviving the wind storms and tornadoes that we have in my area of the country. So this is a distortion caused by another outside influence, in this case, a tree falling down. Well, neural networks can be distorted by childhood training and indoctrination. And so we see that during the window that's opened, as we know, many religions want to take us and indoctrinate us when we're most vulnerable, when those windows are open, when the social skills and understanding of the social environment is being learned, and it affects the infant and it affects the young child, and it can affect their ability to bond with others. For example, what if you live in a high control cult or environment where the parents have a lot of control over you, and when you disobey, you get beaten regularly? So, and that's not uncommon in many fundamentalist kinds of religions. So this kind of child rearing, spare the rod, spoil the child kind of child rearing, can have major consequences on how that child attaches or fails to attach, or inappropriately attaches. And so we get the notion that children who are, I'm sure many of you have seen this, children who are from incredibly abusive households still cling to their parents. They're attached to their parents despite the abuse. And it makes no sense to an outside observer why a child would be like this. Why would they still love their parent? But that's how strong the need to attach is in children. And that's the only protection they have. So they've got to attach here. It also means that the child may not develop a sense of agency because they have no control over their life. They never learn how to assert themselves or find their own likes and dislikes. And it can lead to extreme fear of conflict, because every time you get in a conflict with somebody, you end up getting spanked, or you end up getting berated or shamed. And there's lots of things that happen. And these things impact our neurological functioning and our developmental process in our brains. Whether we want to call this trauma or not, whether it's diagnosed as trauma or not, we still know that there's behavioral changes, there's shame, there's guilt, there's conflict avoidance, there's lots of behaviors that are directly related to this early childhood training. David, could I get you to read this?
Absolutely. So we have an example here, living under a rock. I feel like I lived under a rock my whole life. Homeschooled, purity culture, church 5 times a week, mission work, only reading approved books, Christian radio, and so much more. This sounds really familiar. Leaving the church was like being born again, only I was like a baby in an adult body. I had no idea how to relate to normal people. I certainly did not have a clue how to date, and even less about sex. Where does even one begin after such indoctrination? I've been out for 4 years now and still trying to figure things out. It's like trying to learn a whole new language as an adult. This is a RFR client.
This comes right off of our chat line. All I had to do was copy and paste. Now, if you read, as you heard David read this, could you see elements from this one example of all the things I've already discussed? And here's where I'm hoping that you're starting to take some notes. If something like I've said so far seems true for your life, or maybe somebody you know, but I'm focused mainly on you tonight, write it down. Make a note of it. You know, that thing that Daryl said seems to apply to me. There's going to be many more coming up here soon. So keep in mind, I've got a whole lot of these kinds of case studies or brief case studies. And I think I looked through our chats, and Dave and Rob can verify this, as Karen, Helen could too. I didn't have to look more than about 3 days in our chats to get all the examples I'm showing you tonight. That's how often we get these kinds of stories. So I want to introduce you to a concept called adverse childhood experiences. There's a lot of research behind this, but ultimately it comes down to a very specific problem that developmental interruptions with the child create the potential for adult trauma. And as Richard Bentall of the British Academy says, the link between childhood adversity and mental illness is as strong as the link between smoking and cancer. The research goes back quite a ways in this area. And if you want to do it, you can get online, search for adverse childhood experiences. I think we've got a link up there. Kara put the link up there in our chat. So you can go, don't do it now, but you can go take this simple survey. I think it's only got 10 questions. And what it'll do is it'll help you identify, did you experience an adverse childhood experience? And if you did, then it's possible, it's not certain, but it's possible that experience is affecting you in adulthood. Partly because these experiences happen when the child's brain is in a very critical developmental phase. And that's all I'll say right there. But do go look it up later, because I think it's put out by the Center for Disease Control. It has about 15 or 20 years of research behind it. very well validated. And since it came out about 10 years ago, this survey I'm telling you now, there have been quite a bit of other research that's come out about it as well. So what if the caregiver is the source of the trauma? David, would you mind reading this one?
Yeah, this is from Vanderkolk's book, The God Who Keeps the Score. If your caregivers are the source of the pain and blame you for what's going on, you blame yourself. So the issue of self-blame is almost universal in chronic trauma and is pervasive in psychiatric practice because so many people are traumatized and have had childhood trauma experiences.
So what we're seeing here is the thing we've already gone over several different ways, and that is that trauma can come from early childhood training, from the caregiver, the indoctrination, the shaming and the blaming and the punishments that come can really have a long-term effect from that treatment. Dr. Vanderkolk's book is very popular, The Body Keeps the Score. I've got some problems with some of the evidence behind what he says, but generally speaking, he's got some strong advice and strong understanding of a lot of what's going on when people experience trauma. So if you, I'm okay with recommending the book. I just say if you decide to read his book, which I think is worth reading, be aware that there's some controversy around some of the claims he makes. I won't go into a lot of detail, but you know, I just want to give both sides of that particular coin here. So religious trauma often comes from the caregiver, as we mentioned. So here's where I want you to grab a pencil and a paper and check off some items that apply to you. And I'm going to discuss these over the next 8 slides. I'm going to go pretty fast. So if you catch one, mark it. If you don't, I don't want to spend a lot of time with each slide. But religious sexual abuse, obviously. Everybody could agree that that's probably a place where you're going to leave that indoctrination with some real trauma. Religious emotional abuse. And what we see in recovery from religion is the doctrine of hell, the Armageddon, the isolation, the abandonment that comes from shunning and stuff like that. All those things coming from religious sanctions if you don't believe some of the stuff. So among those first 3 there, just check, you know, did I experience any of those? Or do I know somebody that might have experienced those? Of course, you've also got physical danger from arbitrary punishment. I mean, the child who doesn't get their Bible verse memorized, 7 years old, and their parent comes home, says, show me your Bible verses. Have you got them memorized? And if you don't, you get spanked. You know, that looks arbitrary from the child's perspective. They do not understand what's going on here. And as a result, it creates a potential for long-term trauma in the child. And if you think about it, that child has no ability to escape. If the child is in a home that's high control, lots of punishment, lots of blame and shame, where do they go for security? Where do they go for safety? They may even try to go to their room there and have some alone time, but the parent might barge in and, you know, interrupt their privacy, or the parent might barge in and yell at them or something. There is no safe environment. Now, I want to make a parallel here. If you were in Ukraine right now, or any war zone, and there was bombs dropping every day, your brain would be on startle all the time. That is analogous to what is happening to a child who's in a home like that, where there is no opportunity to relax. There's no opportunity to feel safe in the arms of the caregiver. And this is critical to understanding how adult trauma comes from childhood training. When there's no safety or no security, the child has a hard time attaching, feeling safe, and going through normal developmental phases that other children might be going through. As a result, they're going to be acting out and behaving in ways that are directly related to the stress of being in this firing zone all the time. And of course, when you get to people like homeschool children, it's even worse, because at least the child in maybe a more normal home, they may be a tough home to be in, but at least they can go to school and they may have friends there and they may have a teacher that pays special attention to them. Those kinds of things can be mitigating circumstances. They also may have somebody from outside, like an aunt or an uncle, that takes special attention for them. Those can mitigate the trauma. But if you have a homeschool child, I mean, just look at the Duggar family and what's coming out now about that family and its dynamics and how pretty horrible the children were treated by the caregivers. There's a lot going on there, and it all is coming from the caregivers. The social isolation is probably one of the most important, because remember, at the time the child is trying to learn social skills, they're being isolated. They're not being taught how to interact. Go back to that case study that we read a little bit earlier. The person said, I feel like I was living under a rock. I do not know how to interact or relate to other people. I don't know how to date. That's all a sign of this happening, that they were socially isolated. And here's another one. Childhood distortions in adulthood. Think about this. Many people ask these questions. We see this in our helpline. People say, why do I have a nagging fear of hell after I left religion? Why do I still feel guilty about my sexual thoughts, even though I know it's perfectly normal? Why do I feel shame for masturbating when I know it's natural and something most humans do? Why do you get so upset when my mother says she's praying for me? I'm sure a few of you have seen that one. Why is it so hard, even impossible, for me to tell my partner what I like in sex? Why am I always second-guessing myself and have so much difficulty making decisions? Why do I apologize so quickly when I did nothing wrong? Why am I so afraid of conflict? And this all this can lead to things like what we call in psychology and therapy, emotional dysregulation, that sometimes these things spin us out of control. We don't know how to regain control. And it can start and last for hours, if not days, sometimes in some people. This just reminded me, Kara, we didn't put the survey up. Can you throw that survey up? And I'm going to give people about a minute to go through it, and then we'll come back and continue where I'm at.
Thank you for the survey shout out, Daryl. We totally lost it. We're like, oh no, we didn't.
Yeah, get it. I'm sorry. My fault.
We'll see if we can insert it somewhere, like, you know, an extra layer of cheese and a nice sandwich.
So yeah, everybody, take a minute. I'm going to be quiet. Take a minute, look through it, and just go ahead and take the survey.
See, this is why we need Kara back.
One of you has to read it.
Yes,
that's the job.
Go ahead and read it, David.
So, polls and quizzes. All right. So, how much guilt, number one, do you experience about your body and sexuality? None at all. Or all the way to number five, it almost paralyzes me at times and makes intimacy difficult. Two, do you have a habit of apologizing even when you did nothing wrong? One, never. All the way to five, I do it all the time and don't know why. It's just the reflex. Three, I guess I second guess myself all the time and have a hard time making decisions, especially when it may cause conflict. Never. One, all the way to five, this is pretty much the story of my life. Number four, I find myself responding to even the slightest hint of emotion or displeasure in others. One, never. All the way to five, I am terrified when I think someone might dislike me or think I displease them. Five, it is difficult for me to set boundaries. I often feel guilty for saying no or asserting myself. One, never. All the way to five, I would feel guilt for days or weeks if I asserted myself.
Okay, thanks guys for putting that up. We'll let that set for people and continue to take it. And then I'm going to continue here. How can I get this off the screen? It popped right up in the middle. Do we have to close the poll in order to get it off my screen, Kara?
No, you should be able to close it at the top with the X. It'll just close it for you, not everyone.
Yeah, that ain't working. I get so frustrated with this. All right. Well, dang. Okay. Boy, I cannot get this thing to go close, Rob. Darn it.
Well, let's just close the poll then.
Yeah, let me see what. Okay.
I did that. I closed the poll. It should be gone.
Is it gone?
Oh, okay. Okay, good. Thank you. Now, I got out and now I got to reshare my screen, right? Oh, I'm sharing already. Okay. There we go. Okay. Hey, could somebody, Dave, could you read that? I know Rob's voice isn't that great, so I'm going to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Rapture anxiety. This is again from an RF archive, 40-year-old who is still plagued by rapture anxiety. I was terrorized as a child by the Left Behind and Rapture movies. Oh, man. I totally read every one of those stupid books. All right. One day as an 8-year-old, I discovered that everything was quiet in my house. I searched all around and could not even find my dog, who's also God and dyslexia land. I immediately thought the rapture. Uh-oh.
Sorry about that. There you go.
I immediately thought the rapture had happened, and I would now have to live alone in a world full of demons and evil. The emotions were overwhelming. An hour later, my family all came home, having gone out for a quick run to the grocery store. They had been delayed when they stopped to talk with a friend. I still get flashes of rapture anxiety occasionally.
So again, this is a neurological system that has been disrupted by indoctrination, religious indoctrination. Here's another one. Go ahead and read that one, David.
Yeah. Sexual trauma. You have to say it that way, by the way. Okay. This is again an RFR client. I had years of religious training, sermons and youth camps, teaching the evils of sex, my body, being responsible for men's lust, and so much more. I got married to the first man that showed an interest in me so I wouldn't be tempted to sin. After marriage, our sex life was a disaster. I don't know how we managed to have 2 kids. I don't blame him, but our marriage should have never happened. Even today, I have desire and sexual urges, but I get paralyzed at the thought of having sex. I haven't even tried to date a man since my divorce 8 years ago, even though I would really like to have a life partner.
Terrible. Oh, this is pretty clearly a dysfunction in this person's sexual life. And we know it's a dysfunction because she wants something different and it almost paralyzes her. It prevents her from being the human being that she probably looks around and sees so many other people able to do. So this relates to the adverse childhood experiences. This constant, if a bomb goes off next to you, you may have trauma. But if the bomb goes off, or it's a small bomb, emotionally speaking, that goes off every few hours in your house, and there's no way to escape it, that's what this woman has experienced. She constantly had church camps telling her she should and shouldn't do, sermons, religious training, shame about her body, shame about her sexuality. It was all these things, and they're like the steady drip, 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 torturing somebody about who they are. And it's all related to religious indoctrination. So you may have emotional responses that are similar to these people. And what we've seen in these people, and some of you may experience, is a deep sense of defectiveness, of self-loathing, that somehow I am wrong, I am incorrect, I am broken. And religion tells us this all the time. I mean, look at this. I think one of the most horrendous songs I've ever heard, even though I sang it for decades when I was still a Christian, is Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, what a loathsome wretch I am. It's just the essence of terrible psychology. Your emotional response might be a lot of shame around your own body. You know, the fact that I can't even be comfortable in my own body, never even feeling safe in your body. We hear this quite a bit. I, I don't trust myself. I don't trust my body. I don't know how to, communicate with myself to feel relaxed around sex or sexuality, or just going out and playing a game with somebody sometimes can be difficult if they've been so deeply affected by some of this. Constant alertness to other people's emotions and responses. We see a ton of this that I can't stand the fact that somebody might not like me, or that I might say no and that somebody will get mad at me, or that I can't deal with conflict. I know people say I would do almost anything to avoid conflict. Well, if what you do in your life is avoid conflict, then that eventually leads to other people dictating your life. You know, it's like going down the street and every person you meet, you have a feeling there might be a conflict with. So you end up walking around the block to avoid that person. And every time you see a human being, you walk around another block. You could end up walking around thousands of blocks in your life that you didn't have to just because you're afraid of conflict. And sometimes it's just imaginary conflict. It's not even real, but your brain is so programmed to avoiding conflict. And then, of course, that leads to extreme needs to please, oftentimes to your own detriment. We see that tons and tons of times. And, you know, you are not number one, you're number three. I'll come back to that a little bit. I am worthless. I mean, that's what the whole amazing grace is. I'm a worthless piece of crap. I can't do anything without a God of some kind. In psychology, we call that learned helplessness. You learn that you cannot help yourself. So you become helpless in your own world. I am third. Gail being the good Baptist, unfortunately, she's not here, but Glenda's here and Glenda can attest to it. I am third. We didn't get this in my church when I was growing up, but Jesus, others, yourself. That's the way the Baptists teach. Jesus is first, other people are second, and you're third. Wow, what an opportunity to undermine people's self-confidence or to undermine their sense of agency and power, their own power in the world. Of course, body is my enemy. My thoughts about sex and sexuality are Satan talking to me. We get a lot of people telling us that. So the question always is, how much does this ideology, and that's what we're looking at here, impact the neurological development of a child and later in adulthood? How does the continued belief in this stuff solidify it so that you can't get over it or change it? A lot of people tell us that it's like living in the body of another person. They can't relate to their own body. It's like their brain and their body are separated in some way. They can't relax and feel like they're a whole human being. I have no control over my own body sometimes. I feel that I need to take care of others and ensure their feelings are taken care of, but my feelings are unimportant. I can't enjoy sex with myself or even with someone else. And sometimes my emotions seem to come from nowhere. Any of these things are probably a direct result of the indoctrination you got. There's a lot of patterns of behavior that come from this indoctrination. And I think one of them that's probably most common, and David's a therapist, so he knows as much or more about this than most people do, but I'm guessing, David, you see this in about half the people that come into your office, the fear of conflict, the conflict avoidance and the denial of their own feelings in favor of other people's feelings. I'm guessing that if you're listening to my talk right now, half the people hearing my voice probably deal with fear of conflict or conflict avoidance to a degree that affects your life. And what I mean that you cannot tell people what your needs are, your desires are, and you have a hard time setting limits so other people can impact you or interfere with you inappropriately. We see another one, and this is less common, but it's still pretty prevalent, and that is perfectionism. You know, you have to be perfect or you're going to hell. That's what religions teach. And the smallest mistakes really can undermine a person's self-confidence. I know people who are almost geniuses. They would make a, they would get 99% on almost any test they took in school. And yet they would lose sleep for days afterwards about the one thing they got wrong. That's perfectionism. And you see a lot of perfectionism coming out of religious indoctrination. And it is an insidious psychological pattern that makes it difficult for you to enjoy life, makes it difficult for you to relax about who you are and be a fallible human being. I made a game, oh, this 20 or 30 years ago, I made a game for myself. I said, I'm going to count all the mistakes I make throughout the day. I just did it for one day. And you think, well, I don't make that many mistakes. But when you start looking at what do we mean by mistake? I mean, not executing an action correctly the first time. So I stand up to put my pants on and I miss getting my second leg in the pants and I have to do it again. That's a mistake. I get ready to put toothpaste on my toothbrush and I put too much toothpaste on it, according to what my brain says. That's a mistake. You could go through how many times, oh, I turn the coffee pot on, but I forget to turn it off. So 2 hours later, it tastes like tar. You know, or something like that. It's a mistake. If you add these things up, as humans, we make dozens of mistakes a day. Well, what if you're a perfectionist that can't stand the notion of making a mistake? Almost every time you turn around, you're going to make a mistake, and it may come back to haunt you because you can't forget that I made that mistake. A lot of people are terrified or even repulsed by sexuality. And they're unable to have healthy relationships with other people. That's almost always a direct result of early childhood training. One thing we don't see a lot, but it is there, and that's scrupulosity. It's OCD with respect to religion. And this comes from, it's like the ultimate in perfectionism. I have to get every one of the religious rituals absolutely correct. And it's analogous to, you know, people who have hand washing compulsions. They have to wash their hands 20, 30 times. And they can't touch if they touch a doorknob, they have to wash their hands. Well, scrupulosity is the same way. I have to say 24 Hail Marys before I can leave the house or something like that. We see that occasionally. Say about once a month, we'll have someone with this issue coming in. But all these are patterns of behavior that are directly related to religious training and indoctrination. When you're a child, your brain is developing a map of the world. How do I interact with this world? Where can I be safe? Where can I have an impact on the world? How can I get my needs met? It's like a map in many ways. It's a three-dimensional map, if you will. I make the analogy in my book, Sex and God, of my hometown of Wichita, Kansas. If you had a map of my hometown of Wichita from 1800, you would see a few deer trails going to and from the river, and that would be about all the map would contain. If you fast forward 100 years, you would see a dusty cow town where cattle are coming in and out on their way to the market. And they'd have unpaved streets. That map was, if I had a map of that town, my hometown, from 1900, that was a functional map for 1900. But I don't have, if I use that map to get around Wichita today, I would easily get lost. There are no dirt roads anymore in where that map was. And there's a lot of new things there. What people who are developing a religious worldview in early childhood is they're getting a map of Wichita in 1900. So when they get out of the religion or when they get on their own as adults, they're trying to use a 1900 map to navigate the town in 2023. The map was very poorly developed to begin with. And they're going to have to completely redo the map. They're going to, and people say this, in fact, one of the earlier cases we read was exactly that. I feel like I had to start all over again. I was born again. I think she said I was born again, LOL. But born again in the sense that I have to totally learn new things. Religious messages are really timed. Religion, for example, most religions don't tell children about hell at 4 years old. Now, I'm not saying some of them don't, because I know that's a fact. But most religions have the good sense not to terrorize kids at 4 and 5 years old. So they tell them how much Jesus loves them, how wonderful Jesus is, how God loves you. And they sing the song, Jesus loves the little children, you know, everybody's love. It's all warm and fuzzy. And it's not until you're about 10 or 12 years old, you start reading the Bible verses that say you're going to hell if you have a bad sexual thought. Well, there's a good reason why you don't want to tell kids they're going to hell at 5, and you do want to tell kids they're going to hell at 12. That's when the development of the brain is receiving certain kinds of information. And it has the most effect on the child in the way that religion wants. Now, religions don't sit around like a psychoanalyst and say, okay, when are we going to teach this kid this? When are we going to teach you that? They don't have to. From centuries of practice, religions have learned, if you want to impact a kid, you teach them this at 5 years old and you teach them this at 12 years old. And you get the notion the Jesuits have, give me the boy till 7, I'll give you the man. If I can brainwash a kid until they're 7, they're basically saying, then, or indoctrinate, I hate the word brainwash, sorry about that. If I indoctrinate somebody till 7, then they're probably going to stick with the religion the rest of their life. So you get these different types of messages coming in at different developmental stages of the brain. And that's kind of the theme of this whole talk today. Where is the brain and what is its developmental process at the time it's getting exposed to these religious practices, indoctrinations, punishments, and that sort of thing? So high control groups often interfere with normal social, you know, and personal development. And it's much like the window of the brain that we talked about with respect to language. It can interfere with socialization, with problem solving. I mean, if you've had a terrible homeschool education, you don't have the skills, the knowledge, the ability to solve the problems you're going to face as an adult. And so you get the Duggars coming out of, you know, people like the Duggars coming out into the real world. And they've never even been to high school. They never have socialized with other groups, and they have extreme awkwardness and shyness because they frankly have no clue about where to go. They don't have critical thinking skills. They can't question the things. They're easily taken in. That's why you look at something like, we've had a good talk here quite a while back on multi-level marketing. Why multi-level marketing thrives on religious people, because they don't have the critical thinking skills to realize MLMs are a sham. One of the people that talked to us about MLMs quite a bit while back, I forget who it was, they talked about the best place to do MLMs is in the Mormon community. The whole Mormon religion is just one MLM, so you can just add MLMs to this. So the last thing is, of course, dealing with the stress of new environments. So people who are deeply embedded with this religious worldview have a hard time adjusting to new environments. And that causes a lot of stress, a lot of other things that come with most people have learned by the time they're adults. One of you, Rob, are you up for reading this one?
I can give it a go. I hope you aren't too disturbed by the explosions in my background, because the people around here don't seem to care that, like, we already had a fire and they're doing this in the woods. I grew up a Jehovah's Witness, and after leaving 6 years ago, I find myself with a problem related to sex and really a relationship too. I read that right? Yeah.
Yeah, you're fine.
I was guilty the first time after leaving the religion and had a nasty panic attack afterwards with extreme guilt. I feel the guilt came from having sex outside of marriage, like going against my upbringing. I don't really know if it's normal or how to combat the feelings, which is why I avoid relationships or throw up a wall if a girl gets too close to me. I don't really know how to handle these emotions or really how to separate the witness mentality that was ingrained in me from my upbringing, an RFR client.
I'm sure Sasha can relate to that one. Not a laughing matter, actually, but it you can see in that case study, very again, just straight off of our chat line, how embedded this purity culture and from a Jehovah's Witness purity culture standpoint is. You'll notice panic attacks. Panic attacks are a form of emotional dysregulation. And when people experience emotional dysregulation, they often exhibit things like panic attacks or anger, anxiety. They may experience depression, substance abuse. There's a lot of negative thoughts, self-harm, even self-damaging behavior. They have trouble making decisions oftentimes. And it's when you can't regulate your own emotions, and that's a mature adult knows how to calm themselves down. You get triggered by something and you say, okay, I can figure a way around this. I can take a deep breath and focus on what I'm doing or what I want to do or how to get away from the trigger. Those are characteristics of someone who knows how to calm themselves down. Religion, unfortunately, interferes with your ability to emotionally regulate. And there ends where we're going to go next. How does religion affect the brain? There are three important components that we're going to talk about, and they're not all. I'm just going to pick the major ones. This is fear. Fear is something we experience through the limbic system. I won't go into detail about it, but the limbic system is a system in our brains that helps keep us safe in our environment. Disgust. The insula is related in our brain. Insula is related to our sense of disgust, and last attachment. So what happens in the limbic system is we are observing our environment, and we're trying to say, how do we stay safe? What do we be afraid? What should we be afraid of? What can we not be afraid of? And there's a whole organizational structure in our brains that helps us identify what things are dangerous, what things are not. And when you experience danger, oftentimes you get into fight or flight, or sometimes freeze mode. Any of those three things can be a normal response to terror or something very scary in your environment. Well, in religion, we're getting constantly trained to be afraid of things. And so the limbic system is literally getting trained by the religious indoctrination in a way that keeps the autonomic nervous system on high alert. It's called the sympathetic nervous system within the autonomic nervous system. And the limbic is a subsystem of all this. I know this sounds way too complex, so don't worry about the details. But we have a system that alerts us, gets us hyper and ready to fight or flight or freeze. And then we've got a system that is designed to help us relax, to go to sleep, for example. Your system, your parasympathetic system brings you to a point where you can relax and go to sleep at night. But if your limbic system is constantly being stimulated, constantly being thinking, oh, I'm going to hell, it's going to be hard for you to go to sleep, or you're going to end up with night terrors, or there might be dreams that plague you, or you can't get a straight 4 hours of sleep without waking up with a cold sweat. There's things like that happen to people. When that parasympathetic nervous system can't relax. Religion constantly teaches us to fear, and it puts us into hypervigilance oftentimes. if you've still, we've heard from people saying, I'm still afraid of hell. I'm an atheist. I'm still afraid of hell. If you're in constant fear, then you're probably going to respond to your emotional environment, to your physical environment, inappropriately at times. You're going to have an anger outburst. You're going to respond to somebody inappropriately. You're going to misread people, thinking they're attacking you or insulting you, or, you know, or there's something dangerous in the environment. So you will misread other people's emotions. But all this is the limbic system trying to protect you from your imagined danger. But it's imagined danger given to you by religion. For example, Sherry and I, when we were in Australia, stopped and talked to some Jehovah's Witnesses out on the street. If I went up to a Jehovah's Witness and I said, I'm an apostate, that all the words would have to come out of my mouth is I'm apostate. You would see their terror almost instantly on their face. And they would not speak anymore. They would move. They would get out of there because they've been taught that you are the worst thing on the planet if you're a Jehovah's Witness apostate. Well, there's many other religions like that too. I mean, some of us who are atheists get that response when we tell anybody that we're an atheist. You know, I got to get away from you. Are you contagious? We get that. But that's the limbic system responding to us as it was trained by religion.
Dr. Ray, so the last time I put up with Jehovah's Witnesses discussing this with me for a half hour because I didn't want to be rude at my door, all I had to say was, I'm an apostate, and they would have walked away?
Probably, yeah.
I could have saved myself.
You could have saved yourself a lot.
Arguing about the details of the Bible and it's not a good book. Oh,
yeah, man. Right. I would refer to Shasha or Sherry, though, for the details.
Next time.
I could be wrong, but I think that's the case. So trauma... this is trauma we see right here in the limbic system responding to the religious abuse that came to you during childhood. Fear of hell, fear of your own body, fear of sexual thoughts. I mean, how many people are terrorized by the fact that they had a sexual thought and they know that I've had that sexual thought, now I'm going to hell? That sexual thought can really disrupt your ability to develop normally as a sexual human being. And so it creates a deep sense of shame for simply liking sex or liking porn. It forces people into gender binary when they may not fit the gender binary for whatever reason. It shames LGBTQ people. So you get the pray the gay away kind of stuff and the shaming of people for not fitting in with the biblical version of what sex and sexuality should be. And it terrorizes children and teens for simply being curious about sex. Asking the wrong question in Sunday school can get you in a hell of a lot of trouble. I know I did that. It also comes to, and I won't go into my talk, but you might reference my talk on sex and porn addiction. It brings people to label each other as sex and porn addicts. And when somebody says, I'm a porn addict or I'm a sex addict, I always ask them, well, who diagnosed you? And it's almost their mother-in-law, you know, or their wife or husband or somebody. It's never a psychologist. And if it is a psychologist, go complain to the board, ethics board, because there's no diagnosis for these things. Go watch my talk on the myth of sex addiction and porn addiction if you want to know more. The second thing we're going to talk about is insula. The insula deals with the disgust pathway. Now, those of you who have your cameras on, I want to give you a little experiment to do. And those of you who don't have your cameras on, that's okay. Look at somebody that does have their camera on. We're just going to do a little experiment. If I was in a room of people, I'd have you turn to each other and do this. But if you've got your camera on, I would like you to briefly, you know, hold it for about 5 seconds. Hold the look of disgust. You something just came to you and you are disgusted by it. So if you looked at a face that had disgust, the research shows that your brain responded to that, and you probably, and of course, this being on Zoom, it may not work, as well, but you probably had a brain, you're in your brain, you responded with some kind of disgust response as well. So the finding of the research that I've been looking at is the insula is activated both during the observation of disgusted facial expressions and during the emotion of disgust evoked by things like unpleasant odors. So we actually communicate disgust, which is a pretty good thing. If I eat something that's disgusting and I, ooh, that was nasty, I'm disgusted, you probably want to know because you don't want to bite into that. If you got it on your plate, you don't want to eat it. So disgust is probably an important thing to communicate, especially with respect to smells and tastes. But what religion has done is religion has taken disgust and uses it in their own indoctrination. Some authors have suggested that religion taps into our disgust system, the insula in the brain, that responds to rotting food, disease, and filth. And the examples we can find pretty easily. How many times have you heard religion use the disease model to describe other people? Sinners are sick and need of the healing power of Jesus. Those dirty atheists, filthy sex addicts, disgusting homosexuals, those are all disgust messages coming right out of religious indoctrination. And please note how often religions teach about filth, disgusting behavior, disease, dirty, repulsive. When discussing these things, it goes against their religious morals and ideas. In other words, they've taken religious morals and put disgust as the opposite. So if it's disgusting, that means it violates our religious morals. I've seen this all my life, but I didn't recognize it until about 10 years ago when I was writing The God Virus. Disgust is such an important component of many religions. And it doesn't matter whether it's Christianity or Hinduism, Mormonism, Islam, they all use disgust. So there's real consequences to this, and that's disgust can really disrupt your sexual relationships. If you've been taught that sex is disgusting, then when it comes time to engage in an intimate relationship, you may have trouble. Lots of natural behaviors and tendencies we are taught are disgusting. And they're not the same from religion to religion. Eating pork is disgusting to a Muslim. It's delicious to a Christian. So we get real difference in is what is disgusting and what is not disgusting based on what religion is. Eating meat of any kind could be disgusting to many branches of Hinduism. And many religions shun people or isolate them under the guise that they are disgusting. They are diseased. Jehovah's Witness do this great. Mormons do this great. Islam, Muslims do it as well. This can actually come down to creating a cycle of compulsive sexual behaviors in the sense that if I think something's disgusting and yet I'm drawn to it, if I tell everybody else I think pornography is disgusting, I'm also thinking about pornography. In my brain and my desires, my normal sexual desires, are probably going to lead me to express this, my sexuality in some way. And as a result of that expression, I will feel disgust. But I will feel disgust against my own body. That's pretty crazy. To have disgust around your own body on something that's perfectly normal. We see this a lot in other things like the taboos that we have around sexual thoughts and sexual acts. And the resistance that we try, for example, I want you to do what I'm going to tell you right now. Be sure and do what I tell you to. Are you ready? Don't think of a red elephant. Now, I'm guessing that most of you didn't do what I told you. You don't know how to follow instructions. I know Kara violated the instructions. I saw the smile on her face. So I'm going to tell you, don't think of sex. Don't think of pornography. Don't think of that person you work with that you're very sexually attracted to. And what are you going to do? Your brain instantly goes to there. And it's like the red elephant. I told you not to listen, look, think of a red elephant, but your brain instantly went there. The church is constantly telling you, don't think of these things. It's disgusting. And yet your brain is being attracted to those things. So you'll engage in those sexual acts, or you'll masturbate to the pornography or whatever you do, and then you'll feel intense guilt and shame. And then if you're a preacher, you're going to get up Sunday morning and preach against it and tell people how disgusting it is and how anybody who does it's going to hell, even though that preacher did it that morning before he came to the service to preach the sermon. And so you get the phenomena of sexually abusing priests and ministers and Sunday school teachers. You know, I saw something the other day. I can't remember her name. She's with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, I believe. Anyway, she said something like, "You know, there's no evidence that drag queens are molesting children. That only happens in churches." That was her quote. I thought that's pretty interesting. And yet, you've got all these Christians running around saying that they are, they're against drag queens, and drag queens are groomers, and all this, you know, that's the latest attack on the LGBTQ community. Well, the fact is, where would they get that idea? It's probably because that's what they themselves are attracted to, or expressing in some inappropriate way, or feeling disgusted about because they do it themselves, or they fantasize about doing it themselves. Anyway, you do the behavior. You feel disgust, you go repent to the priest, minister, read your Bible, and then you rinse and repeat. And that's what I call the guilt cycle. I write about that extensively in my book, The God Virus. So the cycle applies to all sorts of things, from masturbatory behavior to homosexual behavior to kink to heterosexual. You know, and vast majority of our sexual thoughts are something that fall outside of the religious norm. So no matter what we do, we are going to feel disgust. Now, next is attachment. These are cute little prairie voles, and they have high levels of oxytocin in their brain, produced in their brains. And as a result, they bond. Oxytocin is one of the chemicals, one of the hormones that helps mammals bond. And there's very few mammals that mate for life and bond for life, but these two little creatures do that. You can actually disrupt the monogamy of these little prairie voles simply by putting a blocker for oxytocin into their food or spraying it into their nose. And the bond will break because they need the oxytocin to stay connected in a monogamous relationship. There's also a lot of evidence that humans are exactly the same. Oxytocin is one of the hormones, not the only. I don't want to be oversimplifying hormones that we need to bond and mate with people. So attachment and emotional regulation go very close together. Notice this picture here, where it's all warm and fuzzy, isn't it? Attachment systems can be disrupted by religious training. Spanking, berating a normal child, shaming them, embarrassing them in public. We've heard so many times of girls, of teenage girls, being forced to go in front of their Baptist churches. It seems to happen a lot in Baptist churches, and confess their sin of having sex outside of marriage in front of the whole congregation. They never make the boy do it, but they make the girl do it. How traumatic would that be? Or a cold response from a caregiver for violating religious rules. That can really disrupt attachment, arbitrary discipline we've talked about before. You're only worthy if you're serving the wishes and desires of your caregiver. So religious parenting creates a lot of rejection, a lot of punishment, a lot of demonizing. And we've kind of mentioned a number of these before. I have a relative whose child was born with a birth defect. And the mother was a Pentecostal Christian. She had had sex outside of marriage. She had had the baby without being married. And she interpreted the birth defect in her own child as a judgment from God, and she treated her own child like a pariah, and the attachment never happened. You could tell she treated that child like it was diseased, and it was her own projection of her, quote, sin of having sex outside of marriage that she put on her child. Now, the unfortunate thing is, when her child grew up, her child did exactly the same thing to her child. It's a third generation of trauma from a religious notion that you have sex outside of marriage is going to cause disease in your child or birth defect in your child.
Apparently, that's not limited to Christianity. We had somebody on an R4X session a couple of years ago who was on a student visa in the United States, and he was partially blind. And he mentioned that his blindness is seen as a punishment from Allah.
Yep. I've heard that from Islam too. Yeah. So religion hijacks our attachment system. And think about this. This is one of the most important things we're going to learn here tonight. Look at what religion teaches us. Jesus loves me. I am safe in the love of God. I am a child of God. I belong to God. He walks with me and he talks with me. He's my shepherd. I owe him everything. If you've been in religion at all, especially Christianity, you've heard all of these messages. All of these messages are related to our attachment system. In other words, it's saying, attach yourself to Jesus. And that's what the message is over and over again. Remember, it was Jesus, others, yourself. Attach yourself to Jesus. Big message. And it deals with our attachment system that's in our brain searching for who to attach to, who's safe. How many messages does Christianity give that this is the place to attach? What about this one? Jesus loves me, I'm safe, all these messages. And we end up with a unhealthy attachment. And that means we need constant need for approval, conflict avoidance, many of the things I mentioned already, second-guessing yourself, needing parental family approval in adulthood, shame for simply asserting your agency, or constant fear of abandonment. All those things could be signs of an unhealthy attachment. So the attachment to Jesus, instead of your own children, or your own spouse, or whatever, is abusive. And it creates an unhealthy, detached personality that can't interact with other people. It also brings up deep fear of abandonment, fear of isolation, fear of rejection, inability to choose trust others. And we see people choosing abusive partners because that's where they were attached. They were attached to abusive parents. And they'll go out. And I've seen people do it up to 3 and 4 times, marrying people who are clearly abusive. They don't ever seem to learn the lesson. Well, it's because of that early childhood inability to properly attach. So parts of your brain, they literally don't talk to each other. The limbic system doesn't communicate well with our rational system. So I know there's no such thing as hell, but I still fear it. You hear that a lot. I know I shouldn't go back to church, but I still feel a strong desire to go back. Why do I want to be with my toxic religious parents? Why do I miss my church meetings? What has happened here, I think, is fascinating. What has happened is the church has substituted parental attachment to religious attachment. You are now attached to the church. And so when you are confronted with leaving the church or being shunned or thrown out, your brain has an alarm system that goes off. I call it the detachment warning. Detachment. And I bet you've never heard this term before. But people get panic attacks. People lose their ability to emotionally regulate when they feel they're going to lose an important attachment. In this case, it's the church. So you get acute detachment anxiety leads to panic attacks. Chronic detachment anxiety leads to loneliness. And I look at this and I say, why do people keep going back to church? I see people who left the church multiple times and go back. Well, it's the same thing you see in marriages. People leave an abusive relationship, but then they go back. I've seen people go back to the same dozens of times. they'll get abused and beat the crap out of them. Their husband will beat the crap out of his wife. She'll leave. She'll go to a shelter of some kind, and 2 weeks later be right back in the home apologizing, and he will apologize to her, and they'll go right through the cycle again. So it's this detachment. We are so afraid of losing the attachments we've got, even when they're unhealthy. And that's what church does to us. It attaches to our attachment system. And the brain wants to go back to safety. And you get this cortisol bath in your system that, and stress hormones and, you know, all the anxiety that comes from being separated from your family. How many times do we hear this from Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons? I feel so lonely. I'm so afraid of leaving the church. I'm so afraid of being shunned by my family. And you get all this response from people. And I just think it's related to the fact that the church has hijacked our attachment system. So I want to make sure we understand this piece right here. You want to go back to church because of your attachment system. The religion has hijacked. Now, this is another interesting angle. I've never seen this before. I recently came across it with a cultural anthropologist. I should have put a reference here. I didn't get it. How do millions of people sing with gusto and joy about their own subjugation, about their abuser's redeemer or redeemer's power and glory, about their own worthlessness and insignificance? Now, let me look at this. If you're raised in a Christian environment, these will be very familiar to you. Anybody ever sang this song? I mentioned it earlier. Singing about my worthlessness and deserving of eternal punishment. Or how about this song? Jesus loves me because I am weak and he is strong. My abuser is strong. Read this. I am weak, but my abuser is strong. How about this? Trust and obey my abuser. My grandmother loved this song. This was her favorite church song. She would, if we had a sing-along and people could request songs, this would be the one she requested. But I look at this now and think, that's trust and obey my abuser. Or how about this one? The Lord is my salvation from the hell he created for me. That's what this song is all about. Or how about this one? I'm just a willful, worthless subject to my master. There's power in the blood. Wow. This is a great, if you read these words in this song, they're horrible. And yet I sang them with almost no consciousness of what they meant when I was a child. So people are constantly in church singing of their abuser's power and glory and of being a happy slave of my abuser. Praise my master for not punishing me for being simply human. So how do people sing such horrible songs except through a culture of trauma? Just as I can't read the right hand side. David, would you read that one?
Yeah. And just as a reminder of some timing, bud.
I'm like, over time. Yep.
All good. We knew it would be an issue and it's all good. Just as at the abused child sees the abuse of their caregiver as normal, so too does the religious person see the abuse of their deity and religious leaders as natural and normal.
I am sure this is not a newsflash to some of you, but it is to many. So read this one too, David.
Yeah, so this is from Resma Menakem on contextualizing trauma. So trauma in a person, decontextualized over time, looks like personality. Trauma in a family, decontextualized over time, looks like family traits. Trauma in a people, decontextualized over time, looks like religious culture.
And that's why we can look back on those songs I just showed you and see people are singing those every day and not realizing how traumatic, what that says about the culture itself. Singing the praises of my abuser, of my slave master, and so forth. So I'm going to move forward through a bunch of these, but because we're went away over time. But I think there is hope. From all the stuff we've talked to, there is hope. Neural networks can be reprogrammed. That's why we have therapy. That's why you have therapists. And the brain is surprisingly plastic. but it can't do it by itself. You almost always need some outside help in some way, shape, or form. But outside help can come in the sense of getting divorced from a religious spouse. That alone might help you get over some issues. Taking a new job in a different city can work. Stepping away from a very religious family or leaving your religion. Any of those things might help mitigate some of the problems that we've discussed here today. What you're doing is you're creating new pathways in your brain. And if you get proper treatment, you can create new pathways and be much healthier and happier. You won't be subject to many of the things that I've discussed today. So what I hope for you today is that if this talk has given you any insight, you might join a group or a community for support to get from others. We have, as we've heard before, we have a great online community. And you might want to explore getting a secular therapist, as you've heard about already in our introduction. Because we can't do this alone. As humans, we're only one brain, but sometimes it takes two brains or three brains. It takes more brains to help us deprogram ourselves. So think about how you're going to go about dealing. I hope you took your checklist and you wrote some of these things down and you took the survey. Let's look at the survey real quickly before we finish up here. What do we got here, Kara?
Okay. Can someone read it aloud?
Oh, yeah.
You want somebody me to do it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Or Davey, you want to do it?
Let's bring it.
Go
all
for
right.
It.
So the poll results. Dun, dun, dun. All right. How much guilt do you experience about your body and sexuality? There were, in fact, 47 people filled out the survey. And there were, in fact, 10. So 20% said none at all. That is fan-freaking-tastic. And so we had, and that got broken down to 15% had two. So, you know, at the lower end here, we actually had 36%, which is fabulous. Although I have to say, probably a little bit having to do with the audience that we have. So a lot of people here have been working through some things for a while now. So we'll take that into consideration. At the upper end, though, we had 4 and 5. Again, 36% were on the upper end. So that was a pretty even split there. Number two, do you have a habit of apologizing even when you did nothing wrong? So one, I was never, there's a full almost 20%, all the way to 5, again, almost 20%. So we're splitting a lot of these things pretty evenly, which is interesting. Third, I guess I second guess myself all the time, have a hard time making decisions, especially when it may cause conflict. Never was 2%. Which frankly, in a skeptical community, I would hope that you do question yourself at least sometimes. And number 5, though, which is definitely, you know, to the point of unhealthy, 38%, that's the story of my life. So there is a malicious level of self-skepticism that can be harmful. Number 4, I find myself responding to even the slightest hint of emotion or displeasure in others. We had 11% at 2, and then all the way to the biggest response was 5, 34%. I'm terrified when I think someone might dislike me or think I displease them. I am terribly sorry to hear that. In fact, 62% were 4 and 5. Please reach out.
Yeah.
There is definitely people to talk with. And number 5, it is difficult for me to set boundaries. I often feel guilty for saying no or asserting myself. 4%, so 2 people said never. And in fact, 1 and 2 of those answers were a full 23%, so almost a quarter. So nice. All the way to, and again, we had this a little lopsided more on this one. So 4 and 5, so in the upper end, all the way to I feel guilty for days or weeks. That was upwards of 59%. So definitely a majority.
Wow.
And again, reach out. Work a lot with people on boundaries and what they are and how to think about them. Reach out.
Good. Thanks, Dave. Yeah. So can we take that down so I can see my thing? Somebody, Kara, can you take it down? So I'm going to, come on. you can reduce a lot of the problems that we've seen. I mean, we have evidence here from the survey that we just did that a number of people have problems with some of the things I've already talked about. But you can reduce some of these problems by various things, like, you know, rediscovering your own body, doing activities that help you get in touch with your body, discovering sensations, yoga, dance, imagination. Those are all good things. And then, of course, we've got professional help. And most of the professionals in the Psychotherapy Project can do many or if not all of these things I've listed here as treatments. I'm not going to spend any more time in here. I just want you to realize that there's help and that we want to help you. Our therapists want to help you. But you can't get help if you don't know where you're coming from or what might have caused some of the behavior. I'm going to shut this down and stop sharing here. And we're going to call it quits for now. Thank you, Kara. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate your help.
Thank you.
Help here. I would be glad to answer a few questions, and I'll stick around for the hangout a bit. I apologize for going over time. I really worked hard to keep it in.
We're going to shun you now, Daryl.
Okay, shun me. Okie doke. Questions?
We definitely have many. I was trying to copy the questions down as they were coming up. So let's see here.
Oh, was that you? I didn't know if it was you or Kara or someone else copying. They always beat me to the punch.
Rob got one in ahead of me.
Oh, okay. All right. And yes, definitely, as noted by Kara, if we don't get around to your question, by all means, stick around for the hangout. So we've got a few here. So let's see here.
Kara, yeah. we're supposed to shut things down at 9, right?
Yep. So we got 7 minutes.
All right. Well, we'll take 7 minutes of questions and then we'll move on. Sorry.
Yeah.
So there's still the hangout after this.
Absolutely. How do you begin
Nobody go nowhere. Nobody go nowhere just because the questions are over.
Definitely. How do you begin to undo or let go of perfectionism?
I have a book.
60 seconds or less.
I have a book I recommend by Dr. Clayton Lafferty called Perfectionism, A Sure Cure for Happiness. And it's actually got some good exercises in it, but it's a rather old book. There's other books that you could look at. But here's the deal. Perfectionism oftentimes requires more professional help. Perfectionism gets in your way of having a happy and enjoyable life because you're always trying to do things perfectly. And it may or oftentimes comes from religious training. So let me just say, I can't tell you in 60 seconds that Dave gave me, but I will say, do a little bit of research and then go find somebody who can sit down with you and help you deal with the perfectionistic tendencies. And you're not alone. There's a lot of people who experience that, especially if they were raised in a religious environment. Thank you.
Definitely reaching out. So how about, can you talk a little bit about the idea that children develop mechanisms to cope with difficult situations, which then backfire when they are adults? Maybe examples.
Well, the example, let's say a child of an abusive parent, and they learn all sorts of coping skills to avoid the parent's wrath and anger and getting punished. So all those skills are designed to avoid the conflict and the resulting consequences of getting spanked, for example, or isolated or grounded or sent to your room. There's all sorts of childhood consequences that come from a caregiver who's abusive. Now, those are functional skills. They keep you from getting hit when you're 8 years old or 10 years old. But now let's fast forward. As I did in my life, I was a full adult. I had finished a doctorate in psychology, and I'm working with a boss that I absolutely love. And as I'm interacting and working with him, I realized I am interacting him like he was my father. I thought, well, this is weird. I don't I don't need to do this. I'm an adult. He's an adult. But I had this tendency to avoid conflict or avoid questioning or asserting myself because that was dangerous. I mean, I love my father. Don't get me wrong. He was a great father, but he could also be, he would spank us. There were four boys. In fact, we would get a good spanking on a regular basis because he was spare the rod, spoil the child. He read Proverbs. He knew what to do from the religious standpoint. So that skill I took into adulthood. I see a lot of people taking that very functional childhood skill into adulthood, and they bring it to their relationships so that they avoid conflict in their relationships, which means nobody is happy, or nobody gets their needs met, or you end up marrying the wrong person, or you can't negotiate because you're afraid of the conflict that will come from negotiation. So that'd be my quick answer there. There's far more I could give, but I'm sure there's that's good enough. Thanks, Dave.
So probably the last one, and this was actually one of the first ones I got asked, and it ties into a lot of what you talked about, can you speak to the validity of the 10 question ACE or adverse childhood experiences assessment tool? You know, obviously promoting it at least initially as a way of categorizing, you know, previous experiences from your resources, but can speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, I think it's a very highly validated, well-researched instrument from the Center for Disease Control. And, you know, what they were looking at is how does adult trauma and its roots in childhood. But this is no newsflash. You know, since Freud, we know early childhood experiences can have consequences in adulthood. But here they've operationalized in a way that shows that if you had these experiences, there is a possibility they're impacting you in adulthood. I want to be clear, just because you had an adverse childhood experience or several of them does not mean you're carrying that trauma into adulthood. That's an important component because there are mitigating circumstances. A child in an abusive home who has a very caring, loving, nurturing aunt they can always run to, that trauma may be mitigated by that aunt who is a place of safety. So all the ACE test does is it points you in places to look. For example, if you're highly conflict avoidant, if you're highly perfectionistic, taking the ACE test, it may show you what the roots of that behavioral characteristic are in your life. It's not perfect. I'm not claiming that, but it's hell of a lot better than guesswork. And we do know it's been validated across a huge sample for many years.
All right, thank you. And that brings us right to the end.
All right.
So
thanks. Absolutely. Thanks for your patience. I will turn it back to you, Kara, David, Rob, Helen. I guess it's going to Helen. I don't know.
No, still with David.
Oh, okay.
Just a little bit. But really, no, thank you, Daryl.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There, you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.